the CU 2.0 podcast.
I'd say a lot of credit unions are not paying very good attention to the digital side from the security perspective, because a lot of people think, oh, well, we're not really a target. You know, and for a cyber criminal, while, yeah, you know, it's great to go after a Capital One or a Citibank, but we have money here too. And many of the cyber criminals would look at a smaller organization as not having the proper defenses and being an easy mark.
And they'd be right in many cases. Do you want to pick a fight with Chase, or you want to pick a fight with a $500 million Long Island credit union? I know which one I want to fight.
Right.
Can your cybersecurity keep hackers at bay? Can it keep them away 100% guaranteed? Can cybersecurity be used as a marketing tool by a credit union? Can a banker, in fact, become a credit union executive? For answers, listen to this podcast with Daniel Ford, CIO at Geovia, a $3 billion credit union on Long Island. You probably know it as NEFQ. It rebranded a month or so ago. It's now Geovia. Ford is the man in charge of its cybersecurity. He joined NEFQ via First Source Bank in South Bend, Indiana, where he was also CIO. We asked him bluntly, can a banker in fact fit into a credit union philosophy? You can guess his answer, but give it a full listen. He makes points to remember. While you're at it, remember that we've discussed this issue in many other podcasts before, including ones with Jim Blaine, Bucky Sebastian, Gary Oakland, and Mark Schaefer. Look in the library if the topic interests you. It's a fascinating topic. Does a banker have the sign of the devil on his forehead, or can he or she actually fit into a credit union world, a credit union ethos? Ford also talks at length about what a CIO needs to do to stay on top of cybersecurity, and also how to work with vendors. The latter is an ongoing process. Always, always, always know that the credit union is ultimately responsible for security, even if most of it comes from the vendor. It's on the credit union, it's on your head. As for using cybersecurity as a marketing tool, you'll probably say, no way. Well, you might want to think about what Ford has to say about this. He just might offer a tactic that helps put cybersecurity in front of consumers in a way that appeals to them. You're going to want to listen to this one. Buckle up. Of course, this is the CU 2.0 podcast. This is your host, Robert McGarvey, and the man you're going to listen to, Daniel Ford, CIO, Geovia.
You are, according to the press release, a cybersecurity guy.
Well, that was my past, for sure. I mean, and that still remains near and dear to my heart. I'm the chief information officer at Geovia Financial, and I made that transition essentially to make sure cybersecurity always has a seat at the table. You know, in many cases, you know, the cybersecurity folks can call out a problem, but they don't really have the power to directly resolve it. So with me, you know, I take what my cybersecurity folks say, as well as, you know, looking at all the other business initiatives and technology, and figure out how to manage the risk into the organization to be able to resolve the, you know, cybersecurity concerns as quickly as possible. Because I know, you know, based on the size of a company, what the annual rate of occurrences for a breach, and I'm trying to beat the odds.
What intrigues me about this is that most credit unions, the vast majority, effectively outsource cybersecurity. In the respect that they're using mobile banking provided by a third-party vendor, they're using online banking from a third-party vendor, et cetera. And part of that deal, in effect, is the vendor is doing the cybersecurity for all practical purposes.
For a piece of it from the mobile application, but what they, I mean, this is probably a great example of why credit unions and organizations need to pay much more attention to their third-party vendor management and how they're going to assess the risks and what they're going to do to hold their partners accountable. You know, as an example, you know, many credit unions and community banks will utilize NCR or Fiserv or a company like that to build their mobile application. But what happens when there's a vulnerability that's found in it? How quickly are they to resolve it? You know, are they being identified? Are, you know, what is the the SLA that you have with an NCR or a FISERV to remediate known vulnerabilities in your mobile and online platform, since they're happening all the time. You know, because the brand risk is still on the credit union. So no one's going to care that NCR or FISERV is the one that was compromised because it says, you know, the credit union's name on it. So we have to manage that.
Absolutely. No, if I'm a member of your credit union and I get financial difficulties because of a failure of the mobile app, it's your fault. It's not NCR's
right.
fault. I don't even know who the heck NCR is.
Right.
I mean, I do, but if I'm a member, why should I?
Absolutely. And so I have, you know, so now with becoming bigger, you know, you have to have a shared responsibility of cybersecurity. So we have some that are in-house and we have some that is external, and we're constantly working together to remediate any of the vulnerabilities that are found. And then how quickly do we remediate them really falls back to what is it called, a common vulnerability system score, which is a CVSS, which is put out by MITRE and the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. So based on that criticality level is how quickly we patch.
What I find intriguing about all of this is, A, obviously cybersecurity is a very, very important deal. B, I'd say at most credit unions right now, they're more focused on the marketing side of digital than they are the security side of digital. That's because digital increasingly is the branch of not just tomorrow, but today. And a lot of institutions are not doing a really good job on the marketing side.
Very true. I would say that's a big reason why I joined Jovia, was I knew the brand launch was happening. I knew all of the strategic decisions that were made and need to continue to be made in order to make Jovia fun and secure and make it to where we can have our members be able to access any of their services and products, regardless if they want to come into a branch or if they need to do it all online. I mean, to me, this was a fun opportunity. I would say a lot of credit unions are not paying very good attention to the digital side from the security perspective, because a lot of people think, oh, well, we're not really a target, and you've got money, you know. And for a cyber criminal, while, yeah, you know, it's great to go after a Capital One or a Citibank, but we have money here too. And many of the cyber criminals would look at a smaller organization as not having the proper defenses and being an easy mark.
And they'd be right in many cases. Do you want to pick a fight with Chase, or do you want to pick a fight with a $500 million Long Island credit union? I know which one I want to fight.
Right. Yeah, and so it's a different threat actor in many ways. So if you're looking at, you know, what they refer to as like hacktivists, then they're going to go after a Chase or a Wells Fargo because they look at them as being the evil empire. So they're not going to come after a credit union because a credit union tends to be more involved in the community. But that's your hacktivist.
Well, that goes back to, you might remember, 5-10 years ago, there was a wave of DDoS attacks.
By Anonymous.
Most of them were aimed at really big institutions. Why? Because if you brought Chase down for 12 hours, that was a headline in the Wall Street Journal. If you brought even your credit union down, that was maybe a headline in Newsday, the Long Island newspaper, and
maybe
not even the New York Times.
Very true.
Whereas if I want money, I want money, and you got plenty of money. Not as much as Chase, but enough to make me comfortable.
Absolutely. It's very true. And so that's why when I'm talking to the board and I'm talking to the executives, you know, this is how we need to focus. This is what we're trying to build. And they're very receptive and are very supportive, which is part of the reason why I'm here.
Now, do you use third-party mobile banking and online banking?
We do. So the provider is NCR Digital Insight. And okay. So what we do on our side, and it's continuous, is I have my folks that are still performing the vulnerability assessment. and we have to do this in a continuous basis. And I have to take a look at the reports that come back from our vulnerability assessment, things that are of critical concern, we push back. They have to fix them within a certain period of time before they'll be released. So but a lot of times people aren't paying too much attention. And thankfully, Apple is with their App Store validation, and when they see things that are bad, they're starting to reject. So Apple's playing a much larger role today. I wish Google through the Play Store would start picking it up a little bit more with their vetting of the apps that are being submitted. That would certainly help out, you know, companies that are on the smaller side, because that don't even have a person to vet any of these updates. So, you know, we consistently vet our applications and our online banking. And we have some other third parties that help us with that.
Apple historically always was much more meticulous with financial apps than with anything else.
Absolutely.
And even Google Play had some screens for financial apps, whereas if you put up an astrology app, maybe a machine looked at it for 15 seconds and said it was fine. But the attitude was, really, did it matter if you screwed up Scorpio and Sagittarius? Probably not.
So, right.
Now, and historically, what I heard about DI, and I don't know if this is still true with NCR, is that the DI app rolled out and it was the app. There wasn't a heck of a lot of institutional modification available. Is that still true?
It is. They are getting better, but they don't have what would be referred to as a full software development kit. So there's no SDK per se. They have some things that they allow you to customize, but not very much. It is pretty much, to me, basic. But with that, they understand that there are other players hitting the market. And with the advancements into the P2P space, if they're not able to be agile and deliver to the banks and the credit unions, then they're going to start losing market share, because there are plenty of people that are coming up with all these fintechs that are allowing you to do really whatever you deem fit. I think that's a big reason why they're pivoting and allowing more and more customization, and they keep rolling out additional APIs. So we're in that particular fluctuation in the market where they have to, and so do we, because when you take a look at some of the mobile apps that are out there from some of the larger players, they look really nice, and that's because they're able to customize it the exact way they want. And we need to be able to do the same thing, because the market, you know, the members that are out there, they're coming to expect that a mobile app should look like this. And thus far, DI isn't able to deliver on that today. But they're moving in that direction. I feel confident that they're going to get there. But it's always better if you can build it yourself. But it takes time, resources, and not everyone has those. You know, when our contract expires, we're starting to develop our RFP today, and we're going to see what else is out there in the market.
We're going to come back to cybersecurity, but let's segue for a moment.
Sure.
I've been doing conversations with a number of credit union old-time leaders, like Jim Blaine, who was the longtime CEO of State Employees, the second biggest credit union. And an issue that comes up is, can bankers become credit union people? or are you tarnished with the sin of the devil?
Right.
Is there an indelible mark on your forehead that not everybody can see, but a good credit union person can see it? And I laugh, but in certain respects, that's a serious conversation in the credit union world right now. Some people say, and it's a good argument, that if you want good talent, sometimes you have to go where you go. And you're hiring people, you're not hiring where they used to work. other people say, no, they're corrupted by a different mentality. What do you say to that?
So I would be leaning much more towards you want good people. And maybe that's because I'm biased, because I'm not a banker nor really a credit union person. I've got 3 years in the financial services world. I'm a technologist. I've worked in manufacturing. I've worked in telecommunications, worked in public sector. I've worked in software development, and now I'm in financial services. You know, I think you want, you know, when, if you look at this like a professional sports team draft, you know, at a certain point you're drafting those high talented people, and then you'll figure out what to do with them, because you want good people, you know, that fit the culture you're trying to build and are talented and bright and are going to bring new ideas to something that in many ways is an old profession. You want people who are going to think different. By thinking differently and having a healthy amount of discourse, you can have innovative ideas. It doesn't, if everyone thinks alike, then you're all going to come up with the exact same solution. So you want people that think differently, because it's going to drive us to a much more well-rounded solution that not only fits the current members that we're going and serving, but also future members. So I really believe you want to hire the best caliber person you can, regardless of where they worked.
Oh, I agree totally, particularly with your job category. Where it gets more interesting is, say you want to hire a head of selling auto loans. What a credit union is supposed to say when you come in is, you know, you can't afford a new Mercedes. You should be looking at a Kia. I'll give you a loan for a Kia. I ain't going to give you a loan for a Mercedes. You can't afford it. Whereas a banker would say, wonder how much money we can make, and I wonder what my commission will be.
Very true.
And that banker is behaving rationally, actually, because they're following a different agenda than a credit union executive, theoretically. So I think that's where the issue gets interesting.
Very true. I mean, it is a good developer. It doesn't matter if we're, you know, trying to develop a mobile app, internal applications to help streamline ways in which we can be more efficient, or just those that are, you know, trying to keep the lights on. You know, those folks that are answering the calls for those that are servicing the loans, which would traditionally call help desk, but what I call technology services here, they're indirectly serving the members. So you don't want to go cheap. You want to make sure you're going with the right talent at the right level. So this way the members are getting their answers in a timely fashion. But it's still that stigma. People look at credit unions as not being big enough to handle all of our needs. And I think today that's no longer the case.
Oh, it definitely isn't the case. In fact, the co-op ATM network is twice as big as the Bank of America network, as I recall. And that's usually what people are talking about, is ATM access. How can I do all my banking with a Nassau County institution when I travel all over the country? Well, in many cases, if they're part of co-op, and there are a couple other networks besides co-op for credit unions, they have more ATMs than anybody else. So credit unions have done a terrible job of marketing that advantage.
I think you're right. You know, as credit unions as a whole, I don't think we do a very good, you know, a good enough job in pitching where we fit.
But it's arguable that that's not true in Long Island, where there are a number of really, really big credit unions that are doing a terrific job of signing up members. I mean, you're not the only big one there. There's three or four giant ones.
There are. I would say this is, for me, being out here and just moving to Long Island, there are. I was quite surprised as to how many large credit unions were out here. And, you know, thankfully, we all kind of market to a different and cater to a different audience in a way. But we are, you know, all very visible. We are out, it seems like, every event that's going on out here in Long Island. So it's quite impressive for someone that's not, you know, traditional financial services to see how involved all, you know, the credit unions are in the communities here. And I'm especially proud to see everything that Jovia is doing in the communities, because that's to me why I joined, you know, so that way I would be able to affect almost every person I come in contact with, because, you know, we have got a pretty large membership out here in Long Island, and I feel very good about what I'm doing in order to protect their assets.
What else do you see different between a credit union and a community bank from your seat? I'm not asking you to comment globally, but from where you sit. In other words, is it different dealing with the CEO? Is it different dealing with the board of directors?
So it, having come from a, you know, my previous role was at a community bank, and there are some differences. The ways in which I communicated with the CEO is very different than it is out here at Jovia. At Jovia, you know, we're looking, you know, they're really looking to provide innovative solutions that are going to help our members. It's not really about the bottom line number. It's how do we solve this problem? Whereas at a community bank, it's still looked at, you know, IT and cybersecurity is looked at as a cost center, not an enablement. So every dollar that's being spent, they go, oh my gosh, we need to figure out how we're going to generate more revenue just so we can do this, because they need to be able to continue delivering a return, you know, a dividend payments out on the stock. They still need to be able to put out the same dividend payment. Well, we don't really have that. And the board here at a credit union, we meet once a month. And every month we're providing an update on the strategic plan. And it's really geared towards the member. Back to the community bank, you know, I have 10 minutes with the board of directors. There's a subcommittee. I get maybe get an hour once a quarter, and the 10 minutes once a quarter in front of the full board, and it's really a check the box aspect at the community bank. Here, it is. I'm very involved because everyone knows that any little small mistake and it could really hurt the membership. They're really focused more on how does this affect the members, and it's quite. For me, as a technologist, I really enjoy this because they're involved and they want to do the right thing the right way all the time. Whereas a for-profit company and a bank, that may not always be the case. They may be looking at it as, well, how do I get one more dollar out of them and without spending any money on the technology to protect it? It's all the profit-based, so it's how am I going to provide a better dividend payment to the stockholders? Here, it's how are we going to do the right thing for the member?
No, I think that's absolutely true. As I said, I've talked with a lot of credit union CEOs, and the two advantages they have are the for-profit institutions put shareholders first. Credit unions, some of them at least, put members first, really. And the other difference, and probably the biggest difference of all, is you don't have to satisfy people on a quarterly basis. And whereas in a community bank, you're on that quarterly treadmill, which forces very short-term decision-making.
It really does. And they're not necessarily doing what is the right thing when it comes to technology and cybersecurity. You know, speaking from a completely independent, unbiased third party, I would agree. Because I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, every decision that I make for the credit union has a short-term and long-term effect on the perceived risks for Jovia. And I take that very seriously. If there's a breach that occurs, it's not just, you know, people's, you know, the members' money on the line, it's also my career on the line. Because, you know, there's one wrong move. You know, this is the thing that people ask me, you know, well, why wouldn't I stay on the offensive side of technology where I would do penetration testing and things of that nature? because it certainly is easier. You can be right one time out of a billion and you're famous forever. In this space, you get an exploit named after you, or you got to name it. On the defensive side, it's kind of getting into, you know, for those people that are, you know, Star Trek fans, you know, the Kobayashi Maru, it's an unwinnable situation. It's not a matter of if a company is going to be compromised, it's a matter of when. And it's a losing battle. So why would you want to do it? Well, because for me, that's the fun part. You know, every day brings in a new challenge. So I have to put the right people and technology in place in order to protect assets, knowing that one wrong move and Jovia could get compromised, or any credit union, any particular company in the world, one wrong move and you get compromised. It's never winnable, but there are certain things that you can do to make it more difficult. We can continue to raise the bar just like they are.
Now, do you see, are there continuing attempts to penetrate your institution by what you believe are hackers?
Oh, all the time. All the time. I mean, we have a third party that assists in the external monitoring of the systems that are out there, and I get a report. You know, for me, I get a report once a month. I have security analysts that are looking at it daily, and it fluctuates for sure, but they tend to be ranging in the hundreds of millions of attempts on a monthly basis. You know, things from scans to, you know, unauthorized attempts. So they'll try to get to the website. They'll try to do privilege escalation on there. They'll be looking for, you know, different attack vectors through the website because of trying to get into the online banking. So, I mean, it happens on a regular basis. And I don't foresee that ever going down. It is always going to be there, and we are, you know, we have to have, you know, 24/7/365 monitoring. And that means we have to engage larger companies to assist with that monitoring, because, you know, we have people that are here during the day that can act. And thankfully, the third parties that we enlist, in the event that there's something serious, then they go through the call triage tree to get someone from Jovia on the phone and move to remediate whatever it might be.
Here's a question I asked a security guy at a very big bank. And the question was, it's 3 a.m. Saturday morning. The CEO of your institution, and this is like a top five money center bank, goes online and begins to download account information from the biggest private banking customers you have. What happens? And he said, oh, within a minute, we'd shut it down. Probably sooner than 30 seconds. And the reason was, this was anomalous behavior. Probably the CEO's account had been hacked. And if he really needed that information, he'd call someone up and we could get him back on immediately. So, which I thought was a reasonable explanation. What would happen in your institution?
I mean, very, very similar. You know, the first part is, you know, the way I look at it is, one, you know, the CEO likely would not have access to be able to do that in the first place. You know, everything comes back down to the principle of least privilege. You only have the exact amount of privileges you need in order to perform your job. So the CEO likely would not actually have access to look at the details of a particular private banking account. So that, of course, would raise bells. But let's say, for instance, they did. We do, you know, we have all these technologies that are provided by, you know, various companies that look for abnormal behavior. And so we utilize that machine learning capability in these technologies that says, this is when people are doing certain transactions. We know a particular end user account does these types of routines on a daily basis. That data has been normalized, so we know what the fluctuations are. And if someone were to do something in that it is outside of the behavior of that account, it would get shut down quickly. And that's a pretty common thing to do nowadays. Because if it's a real problem, they're going to call. And it's better to be safe than all of a sudden, you know, a member in this case to be compromised, or many members to be compromised. So we'll shut it down. Well, better to be safe than sorry.
Basically the same answer that other guy gave me, which I thought was a perfect answer. It's if the CEO, if we shut him down and he's actually trying to access this information, he knows how to get back on. He knows who to call and yell at.
So, yeah, he'd be calling me saying, why did my account just get shut down?
Exactly.
So absolutely. I'd be getting, my phone would be ringing off the hook. And then, you know, in many ways, it's the same thing as the type of permissions that I have. I really don't have access to very much because I know I would be a target. I have people that would do certain things. I get reports. I look at the data. I have teams that go off and do that because I know I'm all, a target. So I don't want access to anything.
That's fascinating because I've always heard that people like you are constant targets on LinkedIn.
All the time.
In the respect that I'm a hacker and I say, oh, wow, this guy, CIO, big, oh, look at this credit. This is a big credit union. I want to be his best friend. I'm going to send a link to me thing and he's dumb. He'll go for it.
Right.
So this actually does happen to you frequently.
All the time. And then, you know, the funny part is in my, I still teach, I still do research. I'm still involved in doctoral research in cybersecurity. So I stay at least reasonably on top of a lot of the technology. And so I'm working with some colleagues that we, when we get these types of phishing attempts, we feed this into a program that we're looking to determine based on certain characteristics through LinkedIn invites and other social media interactions is what the probability is that this is going to be a nefarious activity. So then we take that further and we'll interact with them and to see what they're really trying to do to determine then whether or not it was going to be good or bad.
This gets a little wonky. A lot of security systems and financial institutions really are based on looking to see if money's been siphoned out of the institution. And I've been intrigued for some years by intrusion attempts that essentially are aimed at gathering information, not stealing a penny. So let's say you want to know about the spending habits of members of Congress. And let's say that you knew a particular credit union had a lot of members of Congress. That'd be an interesting place to just sit, listen, learn, make notes, but don't touch a penny. Question, are the security systems prepared to deal with that? Can they detect that, help shut it down?
I'd say the answer is yes. I mean, they exist. When we take a look at some of the past breaches that occurred not too long ago, I mean, I don't remember the dates off the top of my head, but within a very short period of time, we had the Office of Personnel Management was breached. That's a place where a lot of civilians have their clearance information is kept with the type of work they were doing with the federal government. You had the Blue Cross Blue Shield in Maryland, where, again, a lot of government people and contractors had their health insurance. And then you also had a particular, it's called Avid Media, was compromised. Avid Media owns Ashley Madison, which was a place that was supposed to be for those that were having affairs. So all three of these things were breached within a relatively short period of time, but no money was taken. It was all for information, all for data to see whether or not potentially, in my mind, they were looking for leverage. They were looking for leverage for people that had clearances and had maybe health problems or their children had health problems, or if they were doing something, you know, that they shouldn't be doing when it came to their relationship. They were looking for leverage. And in each of these cases, the breach occurred through some type of vulnerability. And then they just sat there and listened while they were able to eventually gain access. The security systems that exist today are absolutely able to handle these. What it takes is making sure that the system was patched, that the security systems are communicating with a centralized technology, typically referred to as a SIM, Security Information Event Monitoring System. And then you have people that are looking at the data, and they're looking, and that's always, it comes back down to the human element. We have to have someone that's going to look at the report and investigate. This doesn't seem right. You have all of a sudden a Microsoft Word document that is abnormally large and it needs all these scripts turned on. Well, probably that's not a good thing. Or even if it was Word.exe, which is the executable, doesn't look the same. We have technologies that exist that can say that even though this looks like Word.exe, it's really not. But it requires back that human element. And then are we being diligent in looking at all of the data? I'm going to say most of the cases we're not. We're all struggling for people. I mean, there's no shortage of news resources out there to talk about the shortages in cybersecurity. So we're all struggling for the same resources. It makes it difficult, but those resources are the most valuable, and the bad actors out there can prey on that. So they're absolutely capable of getting into a system, and just I would argue, probably to your point, it's not the money per se. It's they're looking for leverage.
Also, simply the intelligence. I know there have been waves of breaches of very, very good academic institutions, and some of that seems to be stealing intellectual property, not necessarily to monetize it, but to duplicate it.
So absolutely.
If you have a really good piece of software, well, I don't have to reinvent it. I'll just steal your design. And if I'm in a different country that doesn't recognize our property laws, well, I'm good to go. Now, do you see any possibility, and the usual answer to this is no, of using institutional skills at cybersecurity as a marketing tool?
You know, that's a tricky one.
It's kind of like no air carrier runs an ad saying, golly gee, we haven't had a crash in 2 years.
Right. Yeah,
I'm sure people suggest this every year, but every year it's shot down. So no, we really don't want to go there.
Right. You know, I would say as a financial institution, we're probably not going to talk and say directly cybersecurity, but there are things that have a cybersecurity implication that we will certainly bring to the forefront, like biometrics. Hey, you know, we have multi-factor authentication. You know, that might be a selling point to a lot of people because we're removing passwords. We know passwords are a problem, so we're trying to do everything we can to eliminate them. But we'll talk about, hey, we can utilize the aspects of Apple facial recognition or the fingerprinting or anything along those lines because that does have a cybersecurity application to it. But I don't think any financial institution is going to talk about directly cybersecurity because now they're going to be worried about, well, if we say we have this strong cybersecurity presence, then that's going to lead to people trying to attack us more. And I tend to lean on that. If you're good at it, then you don't want that in the news. Let it, you know, keep doing what you're supposed to be doing. Don't draw any attention to your cybersecurity prowess, because it only takes one mistake and, you know, you're on the homepage of CNN or whatever for our credit union out here, and, you know, the homepage of all the local newspapers. And so I'd prefer not to.
Right. I like your idea of talking about biometrics. So I find myself relying much more on biometric entry passwords. I've written articles for at least 10 years that passwords are broken. And I'm glad that I think we're getting accustomed to using biometrics, strangely enough, for mobile phones.
Absolutely.
I could not tell you my United Airlines frequent flyer number. I have no idea. I don't know the password, but I know the app responds to my fingerprint. That's all I know.
That's right. And it's great because, you know, when I had done some research, you know, several years ago, the average person had 26 accounts they maintained a password for, but they only kept 8 passwords, which meant at least each of those passwords are being used three times, because we can only remember so many passwords, and they're constantly making you change them. And I argue with a lot of the compliance folks, and they go, well, you have to change your password every 90 days. And I said, well, that's somewhat foolish, because I may have had a really strong password that had no reasonable expectation of believing that it was had been compromised. And I might create another one that I could have weakened my overall security aspects of that password because I had to change it. One of the things that I had done at a previous company is that we only made people change their password once a year. But what we did internally is we created a password cracking system, and we had all of the hashes, which are a one-way mathematical computation of your password. And if we broke it, we would go to you and explain why it was broken. We had you change your password then, because this is exactly what bad actors do. So we just took that offensive mindset, put it in a way, and now we were teaching people good cyber hygiene.
Before we go, the CU 2.0 podcast is looking for a few good sponsors to help us spread the word about the digital transformation of credit unions. You could be one of them. Contact Robert McGarvey for details at rjmcgarvey@gmail.com. First come, first served. Again, that's rjmcgarvey@gmail.com. The CU 2.0 podcast.